Hello, and welcome to the first ever Global Soft Foundation podcast, which we are calling Soft Spot. If you're here, you probably already know that SOF is the acronym for Special Operations Forces, but if you didn't, now you do. My name is Chelsea Hamishon, and I'm the GSF Director of Marketing, one of the five full-time employees that we have here on staff. Now, we aren't just doing this because podcasts are immensely popular, but also because we realize that we have a plethora of topics to discuss and people to bring in that we think the SOF community will find interesting. Like, it's almost scary, especially to me as the person who has to make these happen, how long our list of topics and guests is. But this one is a good scene setter because it talks about how the GSF was founded and also about what we do and why. So if you're a longtime podcast listener, or if this is your first time jumping into this sport, I hope that you'll add us to your circuit of what you listen to while you're on your commute, cleaning your house, running, or whatever you like to do when you listen to podcasts. So without further ado, the very first episode of Soft Spot.
And then if we want to break it down.
Wow. Global Soft Foundation.
My immediate reaction was, this is awesome.
Association for Special Operations.
You have our support. Let's move.
Welcome to Soft Spot. All right. Well then, folks, we are here today with Stu Braden, the president and CEO of the Global Soft Foundation, from here on in called GSF. Ranger Rick Lamb, who is the Director of International Engagement, and Megan Keeler-Pettigrew, the Chief Operating Officer of the GSF. And I am Chelsea Hamishon, the Director of Marketing. We're going to talk a little bit today about how the GSF was founded and what we're doing these days. So let's kick it off with Stu. What made this all happen?
Oh, good question. I haven't had to answer this in quite a while, so it's kind of weird. So when we first started, I got asked this every day, so I think it's 2012. I was assigned to US SOCOM. I was working in the operational planning team. And we got a visit from Mr. Keith Mosbach and a few of his folks from the US Geospatial Intelligence Foundation. They were here in town. They were gonna host this big annual event they have called GEOINT. They were gonna host that in Tampa in 2013. And they had spoken with Adam McRaven at the time, and the chief of staff, I believe, was Droopy Clark, or maybe then at that time it was General Linder. But but he spoke to the chief of staff, and they said, hey, go down and see Braden at the OPT, and they'll take care of you. And so when Keith Mosbach walked in, he introduced himself, and he said, hey, they said, you're going to take care of me. I said, great, what am I taking care of? And they sat down and they explained to us, you know, who they were and what they did as far as GEOINT. Sounded pretty cool. I looked at all the agenda they had, and it, you know, it seemed like a bunch of nerds talking to nerds, and so we operationalized it for them. The event was planned for October of 2013. It ended up actually happening in April of 2014 because of the government shutdown. And so we worked with them for right about a year, I guess, to help them execute their GEOINT 2013 here in Tampa. And throughout the entire process, Keith Mosbach would ask me questions like, you know, who is there a professional association for special operations? And, you know, I was working 15 hours a day. I wasn't looking for a hobby. I didn't even know what a 501c3 was, to be honest. I knew it was a nonprofit, but I had no idea what the hell that meant to anybody.
Do you know now?
Yes, I do, somewhat. So I'm smarter today than I was then. And so, you know, the more I learned about the USGIF, I kind of was digging it, you know. It was a partner and member-run organization. You know, it was a professional association. And they did it because the Department of Defense reorganized all these disparate entities in the geospatial community and brought them together. And it was really cool. And they just started building it out. And I thought that was a cool story. I was digging it. I was, you know, it was 10 years later in 2013 that they were doing their 10-year anniversary event here in Tampa. You know, and they probably get 6,000 or 7,000 people attend that thing. It's one of the most professionally run events you'll ever see. I mean, it's just first class. Everything's first class. And I really, really enjoyed it. I said, damn, these guys actually got their act together. But the whole time, Keith Mosbach is just digging in me going, why doesn't Special Hops have this? And he just flat said, why don't you form this? I was about a year from getting out of the military. I hadn't really, you know, given it much thought. I thought I was going to be like everybody else. I was just going to get out and prostitute myself to industry and do whatever I, you know, I loved Tampa. I was going to stay in the Tampa area, and I was just going to, you know, do what everybody else did. And Keith convinced me that I should start a professional association. And so I think I spent most of Thanksgiving 2013 and most of Christmas 2013 going over what a 501c3 was, looking at different things. He gave me the charter, you know, their bylaws and everything, and half of it didn't make sense to me. But any, I mean, I could call he or Amy McGranahan at any time and get any advice I ever wanted.
Was anyone working with you at that point, or was it just mostly you?
But Thanksgiving was me. I put together probably the sloppiest thing in the world. I think I sent it to Megan and Keenan, and I said, hey, I got this idea. And it was, you know, I mean, to say raw is probably an understatement.
You didn't have me yet.
No. It was pretty ugly. And I actually looked Megan in the eye one day. I said, I'm thinking about doing this. What do you think? And she's like, that sounds awesome. And so literally that was it. And so, and we knew, you know, our time in the OPT at SOCOM was coming to an end. And so we started to grind. It was Megan, Keenan, and I. We spent most of Christmas on leave and, you know, after hours, just looking at trying to build the bylaws of the whole thing.
So, Megan, as a mother with two small children, what made you believe in the project enough to jump in at that point?
As Stu said, when he told me the idea, my immediate reaction was, this is awesome, because I felt that the special operations community, although it had grown in importance and size, especially since September 11th, it didn't have the representation and advocacy arm that it needed that would be commensurate with how important it had become to national security. So just, I felt like there was a need for it. And I also thought it would be an exciting thing to do. So it was sort of like almost had a Jerry Maguire moment. You know, I was Renee Zellweger and I got up and I took my goldfish and I was like, I'm with you, Stu. And I walked out.
Does that make Stu Tom Cruise?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mean, he's a lot bigger than Tom
Absolutely.
Cruise.
I haven't had that much plastic surgery. I need to get some of that plastic surgery.
He's not a Scientologist. But other than that, Stu's just like Tom Cruise.
We just lost our sponsor, Scientology.
So... but yeah, it was not a great time for me to make a big leap like that, in the sense that I had a 6-month-old infant at the time. And I, you know, quit my well-paying job and did something a little bit crazy at that point, because we didn't have a lot of guaranteed money from sponsors or corporate partners. But as I like to remind Stu, I was employee number one. I was the first person on the payroll. So... And that was March 2014. So we did a lot of work over Christmas, as Stu said, and after work, you know, January, February. And then we officially kicked off March, I would say, and had our first event in May 2014.
So what made you decide to go international instead of just a U.S.-focused foundation?
That, I think, two reasons. One, it was definitely on the recommendation of USGIF.
Yeah, they were struggling with that themselves.
Because they were just very specific about it, in the sense that US is part of their name.
True.
And now it was part of their brand 10 years later. And they realized that was limiting. But I think more importantly, because of what SOF is, it's inherently global and international, and they all rely on each other. It's so much about relationships and working with partners that you really couldn't do a SOF association just here in the U.S. Yeah. It wouldn't be true to what SOF is.
So you did your first event in May in Tampa. How did you decide what was next?
We just made shit up. Oh, I'm not supposed to curse.
We should. I mean, we can use the soft swears.
The interesting thing was, is so you spend your first 2 years trying to explain, not to just people, but to yourself, you know, who are you and what are you? And we redefined ourselves probably 3 or 4 times, you know, in that period. When I say, you know, we just tightened up our branding, tightened up our verbiage, you know, because we became more intimate with everything we were doing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I could walk into any, venture capitalist office or major corporation anywhere in the country, and I felt completely comfortable, all of us did, with, you know, telling people who we are and what we did. Interesting, you know, we're at the 4-year mark, you know, when we first started, well, let me back up. So when we first started, we were explaining to people who we are and what we did. When we'd meet people that were distinguished, you know, folks, we'd meet people on Capitol Hill and, you know, and in ministries of defense and stuff. And you would always meet some staffer and stuff. And I remember one day we came out, Megan goes, do you ever think like we're ever going to really meet the real reps and stuff? And so, well, that happened faster than we thought. And the downside was, is, you know, the reps were just like us. They were overwhelmed. They couldn't, you know, they were going from one thing to another thing. And we were like, hey, can we just meet with the staffers again? Because it's a lot easier. And so finally the reps are so comfortable with us now that they just say, look, meet with them. They'll tell me everything. You have our support. Let's move. And so, we've evolved over that time period. As far as the events go, you know, you have to like book facilities. You have to put money down. And we had no past performance. So like Megan said, we were just making shit up. I mean, we were guessing. We thought maybe this. The first big event we held was a reception the night before SOFIC. We did that in the History Museum here in downtown Tampa. I mean, how many people
were focused, you know, that how many did we have at that first event? I think we had 400, actually. Yeah, it was a pretty decent
like 250
number
or something.
It helped. Yeah.
It mm-hmm. blew. We didn't have food for everybody, you know, so you learn quickly. Ruh-roh. You know, mm-hmm. this was a little bit better than we thought. But with no past performance, you kind of wing it.
Yeah.
You know?
And that event was meant to be a kickoff. And for the first year, we were very focused on just getting our name out there and having people learn about what we wanted to do. And then we also knew we wanted to have at least one big symposium every year. So we very quickly started working on the first symposium we would have in February 2015. And ended up having it in St. Pete Beach.
Was it hard to get speakers for that event? You know, an inaugural event where people don't really know about you yet?
It was, and that, it wasn't, in the sense that you have to be realistic about who you can get, so you have to leverage your existing network, especially at the beginning. Now it's a lot easier to get speakers that we don't even know.
Yeah.
But at the beginning, we had to have a connection to the person. But that first event, we were able to get Her Royal Aisha. Highness, yeah. Major General Aisha.
Yeah, how did that happen?
Of Jordan.
You just asked her.
Yeah, that actually, we just asked her. I don't really know why she said yes, God bless her.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Someone said she's awesome. Steve Wizotsky knew her. And we just
threw it
just threw it over the fence and said, see if she
But
does
we also
it.
Had, like, Stu knew, at the time, the deputy
NCTC,
of NCTC, Lieutenant General Bennett Sokolic,
yep.
And he did a keynote, and he's a really good speaker. He was very candid. Then we also had a really cool demonstration of military working dogs, yeah, out on the beach.
K2.
Which,
yeah, it was awesome.
Which also, so we really, from the beginning, tried to make the event interesting, not like your run-of-the-mill conference. And then we also were very focused on getting dynamic, candid speakers. And that's something we still try to do and maintain now.
Yeah.
What was the hardest thing about those first, like, 2 years when really no one had heard of you yet?
Drama. A lot of misperceptions. You know, people would, you know, I would hear from people, you know, telling me, hey, I spoke to so-and-so and they told me this about the foundation. I was like, that's funny. I've never spoken to that person. Megan's never, I don't know where they're getting their information, you know? And so a lot of, just a lot of disinformation out there. You know, we were disruptive, you know? When it first started, and I had this idea, we actually put together a sloppy brochure. It was a Kinko's copy. I was paying a fortune per copy at Kinko's. And I actually went to sit down with Adam McCraven because I was getting ready to leave. And, you know, I was planning out my retirement. He was going to retire me. And I wanted to make sure that he knew that the OPT, you know, I was handing over to Colonel Greg Athey, and that, you know, everything was, you know, pretty tight at that time, and give him a sense of feeling that, you know, that I wasn't abandoned. But I just, you know, I was MRD. So on 24 February, I had to go. I mean, I couldn't stay in, you know, it was my time to leave. And so I sat down in his office and I showed him this sloppy Kinko coffee. And I was with the Admiral yesterday in Austin as we were talking about this. And he opens up the brochure and he starts reading it. And he goes, "Hey, Stu, this is a good idea. This is probably one of your better ideas." And, you know, I'm sitting there trying to talk. He's not listening. You know, I was mumbling and he was just reading the document. And he goes, "This is a damn good idea." He goes, "What made you do this?" You know, and so I kind of explained to him what I was doing. And I said, "Let me ask you a question." I said, "What do you think the soft leadership's going to think about this?" And he's like, "You know," he goes, "they'll like it." He goes, "Some of them won't." He goes, "Don't worry about it." He goes, "I think this is a brilliant idea. I think it's a void." He goes, "To be honest with you, I'd love to have this organization right, you know, around when I was the, you know, commander." He goes, "It's a little late in my tour. You know, I'm leaving." But he goes, "I mean, there's a lot of value of having an organization like this."
So I would like to first apologize to Admiral McCraven for that impression of him.
I actually think that impression's pretty good.
If he was here, he would have laughed. Because I did it at the table yesterday. We were having lunch, and he starts laughing. So, yeah, it's good.
He's laughing because of how it sounds.
Yes.
Not due to accuracy. So, Rick, at that time, you were still active duty. What were you hearing about the foundation, and what did you think of it as a concept?
Oh, no, I was, I had retired in...
Oh, you did? Sorry, I'm a liar. I was making you younger.
Oh, dang.
A lot younger.
That's why I like you best. I was working at USOCOM.
You were government, though, right?
Correct.
That's what I was thinking. You were still a government rep. Okay.
Yeah, I think I was, number three? Yeah. The number three hire. And, there's two dates.
No, you were number two on the OPT.
Number two?
I pulled you out of the jog. It was you. I went to you first. And you and I would walk around and steal everybody's we would reappropriate everyone's triple SC in the command because we didn't have any to stand up to OPT. Yeah,
there's like two dates, 84 and 86. 84, I go to Korea. And I'm the typical ugly American on my first overseas tour. And at the end of that tour, I liked working with the Korean soldiers. I was in a little camp up north, and we would eat, sleep, work, train, and live with these kids, right? So the sergeant major at the time of that battalion came over and he said, "There's six of you guys that are going to take the PT test and go to special forces over the weekend. And so do your best, and that's your next move. I see how you guys work with these with our foreign partners, the ROCs, and you guys, your next jump is to special forces."
There wasn't a vote, was it?
No, it wasn't a vote. We did our best, and so I end up in 1986. My first assignment out of the Q course is down in Panama, so I run into Stu, and Stu was that wild-eyed team leader that everybody wanted to work for. And in fact, I think if it hadn't been for Sergeant Major Kenny McMullen, you know, your career would have been very short.
Oh yeah.
But so I've been knowing Stu since the mid '80s, and always had a high degree of respect for him. So when he rolled in 2012, as part of the OPT, I said, "Whatever you're doing, I'm in." And so the two things that most interest me was, one, working for Stu again, but also the whole foreign partner aspect, because I did have a penchant for working with the guys. I just like working with them.
Awesome. So after the first 2 years, when did you guys feel like a turning point where you weren't just getting your name out there anymore, where people actually knew who you were and you were getting to really start executing the programs and having an impact?
2.5 year mark.
So when you hired me?
I was going to say when we hired Chelsea, I that was a turning point in a few ways.
That was a very deliberate, well thought out,
spur
of the moment event.
But it was indicative of our financial condition and foundation being strong, that we could bring on another person besides just Stu and myself. It also meant that we could devote significant resources to marketing the organization. Up until that point, I was doing the marketing, and I certainly have no expertise in marketing whatsoever. And then just for me personally, related note is I was overwhelmed with work. Both Stu and I,
we were out of bandwidth.
It's a long time to be starting something up, just two people. And because it grew very quickly. And in some ways, as Stu likes the phrase, we were the dog that caught the car. We were running and then we caught it and we're like, and I was about to curse again. I just caught myself. So that was a turning point, I think, was hiring, a third person and being stable enough to do that. And then all of what you brought to the table, Chelsea, we were able to grow even more. It set off. It was a catalyst. Yeah. Like it was a marker, and then we also grew from there.
So, what do you kind of attribute the initial fast growth to? Just your network, or like the fact that this was just so badly needed?
I think both.
Yeah. I think there was a void. There was a void to be filled. Yeah. This was a niche.
Everybody's got a professional association out there. Lawyers, doctors, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, everybody's got one, right? Those folks, even they're inside the government that have them, they have strong relationships with those associations. It's a smart thing to do, They don't do anything illegal, but they are there are things that those associations can do on behalf of the community. That people in government just can't do and stuff. The other thing is they convene the community, which is the most important thing. So it's personality agnostic,
See, that was kind of my point too. I saw it first off in the in that initial the crack house over there, 143, especially when the Norsemen would roll in. It was like old home week. That network was so strong that one that you had developed over time. And so I think it was equal parts the solid network, but then the void that they didn't have that. They didn't have this type of venue to get after the stuff that you're starting to see the foundation get after now.
So global in the name is kind of high pressure, obviously, since we're based here in the U.S. How did you work on your international growth, and how did you end up deciding you were ready for the first international event?
I spent, 21 out of 32 years overseas, and so I was a Latin American foreign area officer. I spent an insane amount of time in Europe, and my personal network in Europe was pretty darn good. I wasn't, I felt comfortable with, they were my friends, not just my associates, and they were all rising to positions of prominence and stuff, and so, a lot of my due diligence, as a special forces officer was paying off, in my network. And it was really cool to watch, the people that were subordinate to you rise, as well as your friends that were in the international side rise. We looked at doing it. We have a business plan, right? So we weren't making stuff up. We weren't doing all this on the fly. It's approved by the board. Keenan, Dr. Yoho, our vice president, wrote it. We all, contributed significantly to it. And we pretty much followed the darn plan. It's been pretty damn accurate. I've never written a business plan in my life. It's not rocket science. It's not too different than a military plan. It's got less rigid, I would say, and it uses some different verbiage and stuff. It's, it's financially driven, where often military is, mission driven, because you can't do things without money in the business world. It just doesn't happen. But it had different aspects to it, and we followed that. We wanted to do the first international event somewhere that really mattered. We didn't want to go to Paris. We all do want to go to Paris, but the French have one. We wanted to go somewhere where we thought we were doing something for the host nation that they could not do for themselves, right? Because these are really expensive. Insanely expensive things. Food and beverage for an event, you pay $4 minimum for a Coke. you know, and so the work behind the scenes of doing all the contracts, the speaker management, the, all that stuff is just, it's an insane responsibility. And these small nations, in order to pull that off, it would basically devastate their entire staffs. And they have small staffs. And so we went for Lithuania because Modestas is a personal friend, the commander of the Lithuanian Special Forces. I was there when they put these guys through, you know, their first paces in the mid-90s when I was a major in 1st Battalion, 10th Special Forces. So I'd known these guys, you know, on and off for over 20 years. And now they're colonels. Lithuania Special Operations is a separate service. It's not a branch of the Army, so they have a little bit more juice than everybody else. We'd never done it before, which is kind of crazy. It was not flawless. I mean, the first one we did, there was a NATO ministerial meeting dropped right on the dates of our event, 5 months out. And if I could have cried and gotten away with it, I would have literally cried. I mean, we seriously talked about canceling it, man, because, I mean, it was just gut-wrenching. I mean, because to move everything around, and so we had to fly back to Lithuania and do the dance, you know, and I mean, I'm sitting in the MOD's office with the Minister of Defense and, you know, we're trying to hammer out the dates and stuff. And I mean, it was insane. I mean, we'd already invited people to speak.
I forgot that we went back there until
that. And it was cold and miserable.
It was really cold.
Yeah. And it was just, you know, and everybody, you know, it was just hard to do. You know, I mean, it was just hard to do. It's like the first one was never easy. And, you know, we got through it. I think we had 278 people at the first venue. Mm-hmm.
We actually broke even in terms of money, which was
shocking.
That was like my reach goal. I was hoping we would break even, and we did. We might have even made like $2,000, and we gave it to the Lithuanian
Defense Association
that helped us. Yeah.
And they also had an election right to the thing, and so all the people that we invited
two weeks prior, out of office.
Stuff. And so, you know, we fought through it. You know, I mean, we just kept fighting through the problems. I mean, we had objectives, right? So it wasn't just about holding an event. You know, we don't do events just to hold an event. There is a no-kidding strategic objective. The Lithuanians were looking to bring an aviation aspect to their force. They were basically refurbing 14 Mi-17s and putting world-class U.S. avionics in them, you know, which would make them really good platforms. And it was about as much as they could afford. And we were trying to get dedicated airframes for the special operations folks. We were also trying to get communications, if I remember correctly. The MOD, the Minister of Defense, we had exhibits. We'd never done exhibits either, ever, at any of our events. That was the first one. We had 27 exhibits. And the Minister of Defense went to every single exhibit. And he was brilliant because he'd ask people, okay, why do we care about them being here? What makes, you know, after you've been through several, he goes, okay, why is this radio different than this radio? And for the first time, his staff was able to talk. Now, this guy was a doctor, right? So he didn't know. He wasn't a military guy. He didn't know a radio from a clock, you know. And so he was saying, what makes this one different? Why do we have this? And so his staff was able to stand there over the product and educate the man on, hey, we got to do this, and this is what the deal is. And so, you know, again, all of this for the Lithuanian Special Operations would have never happened had we not hosted this event. And so they were extremely appreciative. You know, they're first. You know, I keep telling them, you're first, baby. There's, you know, like Ricky Bobby, if you ain't first, you're last. And so he's, you know, they suffered with us because it was not easy. I mean, I'll tell you, that was not a simple one to do. We were blessed because we learned so much during that. We went to Romania. And
I think the only thing I'd add to that, just to go back to your original question, Chelsea, is that why, you know, when did we think and why did we make the leap to have an international event when we did? And I think a big part of it is that we were very intentional in being a global organization. And it was important to us that we weren't seen as a U.S. organization. So at our events, we try very hard to have a lot of non-U.S. speakers. And we felt it was important to have a non-U.S. event early on. Because otherwise, it would be very easy to stay here in the U.S., because it's the biggest, you know, gorilla in the jungle. But it also
that famous saying.
I just coined that.
That'll be the name of this podcast. Biggest gorilla in the jungle.
But I think it would have been much easier to stay in the U.S. Mm-hmm. But we didn't because we thought it was important.
Yeah, that was my second week of work, I think, when we went Lithuania. Mm. And I remember walking into the expo hall, and that's when I realized we were actually the people throwing the event.
Yeah.
Which I realized I should have known, but it really didn't sink in.
You've never told me that, Chelsea.
I know.
It's almost like we're in a confessional. Now that these microphones are out, we're like, all the deep, dark secrets are coming out because we're recording it.
No, I did. I walked in and I did the stop and stare and like realized that someone wasn't there, like doing it already, and that we were the ones doing it. And it was a very like, oh, this is us kind of thing. So, yeah, it is a huge undertaking. That's why I really didn't believe that just, you know, the four of us were doing it.
Yes.
But believe. It was cool. Yeah, it happened. Hello, Chelsea here again, and I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I'm here with a very quick promotion of one of the GSF's founding partners, WWT, which stands for Worldwide Technology. You'll hear us mention how great they are in part two of this podcast, but I wanted to provide you with a quick rundown of what they do first. WWT is a more than $6 billion systems integrator that brings an innovative and proven approach to how large public and private organizations explore, evaluate, architect, and implement multi-vendor solutions. Customers have hands-on access to cutting-edge data centers, networking, security, and collaboration products through the WWT Advanced Technology Center, commonly called the ATC. Technical expertise from an expansive team of engineering resources and accelerated global product delivery powered by a sophisticated supply chain management infrastructure. WWT is based in St. Louis, but they have facilities in GSF hubs like Tampa and DC and many more places across the globe. If you'd like to learn more about WWT or meet them at a GSF event, you have to come to a GSF event. A good one we have coming up is our GSF huddle at ITSEC in Orlando, which is happening on November 26, 2018. WWT is the gold sponsor of that event, so you'll definitely see them there, and we hope to see you there as well. Thank you again to our stellar founding partner. And now, back to the podcast. You talked a little bit about the business plan earlier. How do corporate partners come into play? Because they're a big part of what we do.
Yeah, you know, so think back 5 years ago, you know, all the big discussion out there everywhere was, you know, how do you get public and private sector together? You know, everybody had it, was a buzzword, they would throw it out there. Then, you know, you'd go to these things and, you know, it just, they weren't working together. You know, a lot of it was by law, you know, and I mean, it's to this day, I mean, it's a big problem, right? The laws preclude you to work closely with industry partners. You know, Russia and China don't have that problem. You know, most of the countries in the world, you know, they have a different approach to how they're, I mean, a lot of the industry is owned by the government. So they have a much better relationship and stuff. And so, you know, you got to remember at the time also, right, you know, all the innovation, it's still going on. All the innovation is outside of the government. It's not inside, you know. And what we were doing is the government was seeking means to, you know, to militarize commercial products and stuff. And so, you know, I kept saying, if we're going to do this, there's no way we can't do it without industry. It just, we can't afford to do it. It would just be, you know, conferences. And I mean, that what is that? Our big focus was interoperability. You know, we knew that our international partners were absolutely going to be critical. If we didn't learn anything from Iraq, we were never going to go alone again. We just like, we screwed that up, okay? And we were better than that, you know? I mean, we were better than that. And so the real question is okay, how do we make our partners better? You used to use the term the exchange rate, you know, because they say, well, they're not good as the U.S. Well, of course not, because, I mean, our guys get insane amounts of training, insane amounts of money. They have the entire national, U.S. national will behind them, okay? I mean, just that alone is 10 times what these other countries, a lot of these other countries have. They can't compete with that. But that does not preclude us from having a requirement to elevate their capability. And the only way you're going to do that is with industry. You're going to have to innovate your way. You're going to have to get those partners the same toys that we have, the same training that we have, all that stuff. And that's, you know, the government has a role in that. But I mean, the reality is most of that heavy lifting, especially when you're overcommitted in a war, it's going to come from industry. And so, you know, we had to make those guys a vital part of what we were doing. And they still are. You know, I still believe that. I mean, right now, industry is innovating so much faster than anyone can keep up in the military, that we've created all these, you know, DIUXs and stuff all over the place, to where we can try to tap into industry and stuff. And so we're playing catch up to the commercial world. And, you know, to be honest with you, we're not very nice to the, you know, the private sector. People think we're jerks. You know, they don't, there's not a lot of money working for the federal government.
Not us, the government.
You're right, the government.
Not the foundation.
There's not a lot of money working with the government, you know? I mean, it's so there's a hesitancy there. So, but we knew the industry was absolutely going to be critical to the whole thing. And we had to make sure that they were centerpiece in what we did. Same with academia, right? We're an educational foundation. So, you know, you can't leave the, you know, if you want to change public policy, you have to change public perceptions, right? And you do that through academia, right? You got to get people to think the way you want them to think. And so they're absolutely critical to what we're doing. I mean, we have a huge, huge focus on educating. That's what we really do. We try to educate policymakers to make good decisions. And we just want industry to provide a phenomenal capability so our partners are interoperable. And they, you know, that they can fight as well as we do.
So what kind of things are you doing at the GSF to help share those capabilities?
Well, what am I doing?
What are we doing, yeah.
I think, you know, I think the biggest thing we did is we stole a great idea from JSOC. You know, why do something, you know, different than what they do? They advertise their requirements on the unclassified side out every year to industry. They say, look, these are the kind of things we're looking for. They're actually pretty smart about it. You know, I don't know who came up with it, but they should be promoted immediately. But they actually give like use cases, like, you know, here's a vignette or a scenario where we would see ourselves doing this thing. And when you read it, the first thing you think of is, damn, we got that kind of stuff out there? It's like Hollywood stuff, man. I mean, you read it, it's pretty wild, right? But somewhere out there, there's some dude in a lab who's seriously, I mean, honestly working on stuff like this. And so we turn that in to what we call the soft capabilities catalog. And interestingly enough, we just captured as much as we can. We went into PEO Warrior. We got with industry partners. We said, hey, what capabilities need to be in this? And we did it as best we could. One of the big things is we wanted to bring industry to our events. We're not a trade show. We don't have big, huge expos. We get like 30, maybe 35 little exhibit things in the whole. That's where we're at right now, at least. But the catalog is broken down into sections and stuff. And so each capability, generic capability, there's they have to prioritize the countries. It has to be critical, essential, enhancing, or not needed, right? And they decide what matters to them. We make it into a national capabilities requirement document, and we share that with industry. And it lets them communicate with industry. You know, everybody goes, well, that's normal. It might be in the U.S., but it's not in most parts of the world. I mean, the U.S. spends $73 billion, would it be, every year on research and development dollars. Romania probably spends $200,000, okay? They just don't have the kind of money. They don't put the due diligence in it that we do. And frankly, they probably don't need to. I mean, hell, I would just copy what we're doing. I mean, save yourself a lot of money, put that in your procurement, and because we over-assess things. And so we get these documents, they're out there, we feed that out to industry, and we try to get industry to come to our events and demonstrate, you know, that capability. It's working so far. It's helping. You know, people take for granted, you know, the government's ability, these international governments' ability to communicate with industry. But, you know, you got to remember, most of the Eastern Europeans grew up under the communist regimes. And if you were some outspoken extrovert, you ended up in a gulag, man. I'm serious. You didn't run around and engage people. That was just bad. So their ability or their nature is not to go out and be an engaging type of entity. They're more introverted and stuff. Now they are coming out of their shells. They're doing well. I mean, unfortunately they're becoming more and more like us, which is good and bad altogether, but it's great. You know, they're being a lot more interactive and involved in things. And what happens is our industry partners are now, you know, directly connecting to these folks. And we're doing other things, you know. We use our network, you know. I mean, so we have trusted people in our international countries, not all, but a lot, that, you know, that I personally will recommend to a corporate partner, where they form a business alliance with that entity, and do. You can't, you know, if you want to do international business, you can't do it, you know, by yourself. You can't. You gotta have an international partner. And if they want to come to America and do it, they gotta have an American partner. So what you're seeing is, I mean, in business world, they got all this. They actually know how this works. It's business to business. The international part's new for a lot of the partners, so they don't really know who to do that. I think our network has been hands down the best thing I've ever seen as far as introducing people to trusted folks that they can actually go out and do business. At the end of the day, look, our international partners get great equipment. That's all I care about, man. I don't care what the brand is. It's interoperable. It's awesome. It was better than the crap they had, and they're just better. You know, they'll live longer in a fight, and they'll do better. And that's all that matters.
So, speaking of our network, what is it? I know that a lot of people don't really understand the importance of networking, which seems crazy, but it's true. What kind of things do we do at our events to, you know, promote networking, and why is that important?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is the most recent thing we did. This goes back to what I said before about our events. We always try to make them unique, different than your normal event you'd go to. So our last reception that we had the night before SOFIC here in Tampa in May 2018, we had a speed networking session. And it worked really well. It was the first time we did it. We're going to do it again because we liked it and people liked it. But basically what happened was prior to the event, anyone that was interested filled out a questionnaire about what they did in their job and who they were looking to meet. And this company used an algorithm and matched up that each person with, I think it was 8 different people. Mm-hmm. And in an hour, you had up like a 6-minute conversation with 8 different people. So you sat down, 6 minutes time, you moved to the next table, and people really liked it. It's especially good for if you're introverted and you're not the type of person that would just go up to someone at a reception that, you know, it's supposed to be a networking reception. So you're supposed to just walk up to people and just shake hands. Hey, I'm Rick Lamb. But not everyone can be Rick Lamb, and that's why this
no
event...
No one can be Rick Lamb.
Yeah, no one actually can be Rick Lamb except
Rick Lamb.
You guys
are too kind.
But it was positively rated, and we're going to do it again. So that comes to mind. We also, at the beginning, did a version of networking in which we had each of our corporate partners give a 3-minute pitch very quickly in front of all the other corporate partners, just to get the just basic idea of what each company did. And we're going to do something different at the next event, next symposium, where we're going to do a networking reception. We're kind of issue based, where we're going to have like in that corners, all the Intel. If you want to talk about Intel, go to that corner. If you want to talk about comms, go to that corner. And we're going to do that the next symposium. So we're always trying to think of different ways to get people to engage with each other. And for our corporate partners, we give them sort of, you know, a leg up in the sense that we'll send them the attendee list for a symposium ahead of time so they can go through and see if there's anyone they want to meet, and we can broker that introduction. And we also will give them kind of more intimate settings, breakout sessions within the event so that they have a more of an opportunity to engage people that they might want to engage. And we're constantly doing introductions for people. I mean, that is a daily thing that we all do at the foundation, especially for corporate partners, that we meet somebody and we're like, I know who you need to meet. And we facilitate that.
I hear that time and time again, too, at the events, is that the strength of this is the network. And what perplexes me and has for years is the fact that you can drop a bomb on a target. A guy will take a look at it and he'll say 80% destroyed. So he's got a metric on it, right? But we fail to put a metric on the relationship until you need it. And then it's a lot of times it's not there. A couple of things that are in the hopper to increase the network is, we've got a bunch of foreign partners down here in Tampa, international guys, and some at CENTCOM and some at SOCOM. So we're gonna pull some of our guns out, and we're gonna take the guys down to the range, maybe do that once a quarter, once every couple months, and just a chance for them and their family to smell some cordite, eat some barbecue, and pop some caps. I think we're going to a hockey game.
Yes.
Yeah, a couple of hockey games. I think January and February. And because, again, Tampa's got all the sports teams here. So we're doing some of those smaller events in between the larger events just to keep the network warm.
Awesome. All right, we're running out on time a little bit here, but I wanted to ask you all, now that we're 4.5 years in, what do you think the main objectives for the foundation are? Like, what are you most excited about moving forward?
For me, it's we're getting to the demos, you know. So we're kind of like committee run, if you see how our structure. Everybody thinks Stu and Megan sit up here in the man in the high castle making all the decisions and stuff. And, you know, we have a huge amounts of committees and stuff. And, you know, it kind of drives where we're going. I think it was 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, the programming committee and the small business committee got together and said, hey, look, you know, we got SOFIC, it's great, and it's, you know, it's huge. But we want, you know, they want to do more demos and demo their stuff. Like, I mean, in special ops world, man, it's, you know, nobody's going to look at a static display. They'll come up, they'll get free bottle openers and pens and stuff like that. You know, and they'll BS with you and hope if you give them some sunglasses or whatever. But the reality is we're a hands-on community and we're a trust-based community, right? And so, you know, the foundation committees really wanted to go in the direction of demos, right? They wanted to actually touch things, shoot things, drive things, you know, actually see it do what you say it does. And so we are progressing in that area. I think in 2019, we're going to have two real nice events in association with our Modern Warfare Conference there at Fort Bragg. And we're going to have a range event. We did a beta test this year. We thought we'd get 20, 25 people. We had 60. So we went, ruh-roh, okay, this is way more popular than we thought. So that was a pretty good beta test. And so we're going to do a lot of work on the range. There's different types of weapons, ammunition. There's just optics. I mean, there's just all kinds of crazy things that you can do. It's right outside. And the other one is we've got an airport, a regional airport that we're in the process of building out a concept on right now, to where we can do all types of ISR activities. And so it's going to give us, you know, an opportunity to let folks show folks, you know, show the government folks what they actually can and cannot do. And that's kind of unique, you know. We're thinking we're going to have a competition.
These are all things, since I'm in charge of getting the insurance for the foundation, these are not things I'm excited about. Yeah. I just want to go on the record. Stu gets really excited, and I just make
until
a mental list.
Until an airplane crashes.
What could go wrong?
Exactly.
What could go wrong?
Yeah. What did that cost?
Just keeps adding things to it, and
I'm learning
more
about
and
these
more nervous
right now.
It's all good.
I didn't know we were
it
having
won't hurt,
a competition.
I promise.
Competition's not happening next year. We're building slowly. We have to. Yeah, look, he's not speaking.
We're seeing a battle of wills here. You'll have to attend to find out.
Another thing that is exciting, besides the demos, which I know is exciting, and is that we're getting more into the research side of things and hopefully moving changing public policy and public opinion, which Stu talked about earlier. So, for example, we have a contract for the Undersecretary of Defense of Intelligence, no, of Defense for Intelligence, USDI, to do a project about multinational intelligence sharing. And it's our, because we never want to do things just like everybody else, we're not just going to have a report at the end and hope somebody reads it, but we want to make it more dynamic. We're having some focus groups. We're doing some surveys. We're getting international SOF officers involved in the project, so we make sure that their views are represented and we can hopefully make a change in that arena. So that to me is exciting because it, you know, when we first started this foundation 4.5 years ago, this is one of the things we wanted to do and we're finally getting to it. So we're growing beyond the let's get this network together and develop relationships, which is a key component of what we do. But this other piece of it, the advocacy piece and actually making change, is something that we wanted to get to as well. So I'm excited about that. Also, there's hardly any liability in doing a research project.
They don't crash much.
Yeah. And not to close out on a dark note, but we hit on it a couple of times. But the world is a dark place, and it's getting darker. So aside from strengthening the network, aside from the interoperability piece, you know, we're going to go to war by, through, and with, and shoulder to shoulder with these guys. So that's really the serious nature of what the foundation does, is get everybody as prepared as we can left of bang, because this coalition is going to have to fight some pretty nasty conflicts within our lifetime, says Rick.
So to end on a slightly lighter note, the thing I'm excited about is this podcast. So I hope you all enjoyed our first foray into podcasting, and we'll be back. So stay tuned.